Hello and welcome to this seminar by the Hellenic Conservatory, one in our series of research seminars here at the LSE. Our topic today is on the social and solidarity economy in Greece. The title of the seminar is Entrepreneurializing Solidarity, a Pragmatic Sociology of the Social and Solidarity Economy in Greece. The social and solidarity economy as a sector is viewed has become quite central, seen both by policymakers but also by academics, as for addressing the increasing precariousness that we have seen after the austerity crisis, the Eurozone crisis, but also the COVID pandemic more recently. Academic scholarship has illuminated the ways in which the social and solidarity economy can alleviate state and market failures as this third sector that can correct both for market failures but also for government failures. And on the other hand, more radical scholarship has identified ways in which the social and solidarity economy, the actors involved in it, can actually transform the means of production and distribution altogether. So changing, if you want, the mode of production and distribution. In the seminar today, the focus will be more on the epistemic consequences of fusing market-derived principles with conceptions of the social, the solidaristic, within the model of the social solidarity economy. And in particular, our speaker will be presenting findings in relation to how the social and the market principle came together in the period after the or during the austerity years in Greece and with up to the period where Syriza was in government. Our speaker is very, very well qualified to talk on this issue, and I'm very, very happy to welcome our colleague Dimitris Soudias, who is Hellenic Bank Association postdoctoral research fellow here at the LSE, at the Hellenic Observatory, and he is with us for this current academic year. Dimitris received his doctoral training in political science from the Philips Universitat Marburg. He has a graduate diploma in Middle East Studies from the American University in Cairo, and a diploma in political science from Friedrich Alexander Universitat in Langen-Nürnberg. My German pronunciation not very good. Dimitris also has held affiliations with the Center for Middle Eastern and North African Studies at the Free University in Berlin, and also worked in different roles at the Center for Near and Middle Eastern Studies and the Center for Conflict Studies at Philips Universitat Marburg. In his doctoral dissertation, he has investigated the formation of political subjectivity against the backdrop of crisis and austerity in Greece. Dimitris has published, of course, on these topics related to his doctoral and postdoctoral research in places such as the Sociological Review and the Journal of Digital Social Research. Before I pass the floor to Dimitris, let me make a couple of organizational announcements. For those in the audience that use Twitter, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Greece, one word. And the event is, of course, online. It's being recorded, and hopefully, subject to not having any technical difficulties, it will be made available as a podcast. After following the presentation, there will be time for your questions, for you to put your questions on, to submit your questions. You don't have to wait until the end of the presentation. You can use the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. The questions will be submitted to me, and I will pose the questions to our speaker. If you're watching the event live on Facebook, you can add your questions as comments to the Facebook streaming, and we'll pick them up from there. That's all I had to say for the organizational hashtag LSE Greece and Q&A button if you want to ask your questions. So with these introductory remarks, I pass the floor to Dimitris Soudias, going to talk to us about the social and solidarity economy in Greece. Dimitri.
Thank you, Vasily. Thank you for these warm introductory words. Let me just share my screen just a second. Oops, sorry. Hold on.
Yeah,
I want the presenter view. All right. Very good. Sorry for the delay. Great. Thanks. So this talk is the result of a central part of my work with the Hellenic Observatory, and I've recently also finalized drafting a paper to this regard. Let me just tell you a few words of how I came to study the social and solidarity economy in Greece. So this goes back, as Vasily already mentioned, to my doctoral work, and I was interested in sort of understanding why participants of the Sydagma Square occupation in 2011 point to the transformative quality of their experience and what remains of this experience years onward. And indeed, quite a few of my interlocutors carried their emancipatory aspirations into the solidarity movement and later on into the social and solidarity economy. Now, the practice of solidarity has been central in these movements, and it's been described as, and I quote, an imagined community of equals, where solidarity emerges as both a material concern and a cosmological, that is, universal bond by Rakopoulos. Lynch and Kalaitzaki call it a politicized form of love. And indeed, it forms subjectivities and expectations that has normative character. Looking into the ways in which my interlocutors sort of practiced solidarity, though, or how they went about organizing the activities in the solidarity movement, brought forth some puzzling observations. I'm just going to quote a participant of the solidarity movement. A business plan I find very important. It helps a lot, so it is clear to you what you want to do, how you want to do it. The SWOT analysis, the first thing you do. All these tools are totally marketist, but if you look at their substance, some of them you can use for doing what you want to do without losing, now listen, your character. Because you remember what we said the other day, don't become the same shit as them, but as a tool, they aren't evil. So here we have sort of the self-reflexive awareness of my interlocutors that show the morally ambiguous positions, particularly regarding the paradox of emancipation, the limits of transformative practice within the structural constraints of the marketized economy. So part of what I want to do in this talk today is show why market-derived practices and knowledges are not merely tools, but indeed instead carve out their sort of opaque consequences. The social and solidarity economy as a sector in the literature is paradigmatic for these ambiguities. There's a lot of conceptions that I can't delve into because of time constraints, but let's just say, as Vasily also mentioned in the beginning, that there's two dominant strands, the first of which we may call the alleviation strand, which assumes that combining social needs provision with business strategy can alleviate market failures. The transformative strand, on the other hand, assumes that the social economy can overcome inequalities produced by the market and conceive radical alternatives by transforming state-market subject relations. Now, my claim here is that there's a gap in these strands about how what we may call hybrid economic practices and how these, in fact, reproduce some of the principles that SSE actors actually want to challenge and overcome. And I do think this is particularly pertinent for the transformative strand, precisely because of their inherently emancipatory ambition. So what do I mean by hybrid economic practices? I mean, sort of practices I'm sure we've all heard of, social return on investment, positive social change, social impact, amongst others. What is hybrid here is that the performance of these practices does not strictly obey a distributive rationality of either market or gift exchange. And what is economic in turn is that the epistemic presets of these practices are based on ideas from the disciplinary fields of, for example, neoclassical economics, behavioral economics, and increasingly also positive psychology. So specifically, this is to say that hybrid economic practices draw on Benthamite modes of utilitarian valuation vis-a-vis utility, efficiency, maximization, and the normative categories such as positivity and negativity. So the question that arises then is, what does performing such practices do to the social and solidarity bits of the social and solidarity economy? So the tasks then for the remainder of this presentation is to first briefly sketch out the making of the social and solidarity economy law in Greece under Syriza. And this is grounded in the Foucauldian assumption that the law structures the potential field of action for actors in the social economy. So carving out the constitutive knowledges and assumptions on which the law is based will help us understand some of the tensions in the making of the law and the law's normative effects. Now, the second task following from this is to illustrate how hybrid economic practices reproduce some of the precepts against which SSE actors stand. This is grounded in the presumptions of a pragmatic sociology that in the new spirit of capitalism, critique comes at the cost of mobilizing some of the values it opposes. Here, my take is not to just state that hybrid economic practices are not right or not truly about solidarity. Rather, this is about making visible the unchallenged assumptions upon which our acceptance of these practices rest. And the third task then finally is grounded in the assumption of early American pragmatism that meaning-making occurs in tracing the conceivable consequences of these practices. In a word, I claim performing hybrid economic practices have three mutually constitutive consequences for how the social and solidarity part in the social and solidarity economy is understood. These are economization, entrepreneurialization, and communitarianization. And I'll talk in great lengths about this, but let me just first sort of sketch out the field that we're navigating, the conjunctures, if you will, of the making of the social and solidarity economy. We already talked about the anti-austerity movement that brought forth new modes of organization. Sort of the first formalization of the sector occurred in 2011 under BASOC. And this coincided very much with the European Commission's efforts to harmonize procurement procedures amongst member states and generally social enterprise legislation and draw near European Union requirements and definitions. In 16, then, so the Syriza government sort of followed up on their promises in supporting the solidarity movement and formalized the social and solidarity economy sector, amending a previous law. So these conjunctures, I'd like to sort of underline the contingency and relative amalgamation of different types of expertise and what Jana Bacevic calls ways of knowing rather than causalities per se. Oh, and actually what I forgot to say, but which is really important, is that the data I built on is interviews with policymakers that were involved in the drafting of the law, as well as self-described social entrepreneurs, members of sort of social businesses. But these are not sort of the groups that are the collective cafes, but rather those that partake in the social provision of welfare services, training, educational programming, and so on and so forth. So as one Syriza policymaker told me, the 2016 law was, quote unquote, a hybrid model from the beginning because it drew its inspiration from Spanish cooperative law, conceptualizations of social benefit deriving from the French solidarity economy tradition, as well as counseling by the International Labour Organization and the European Commission Expert Group on Social Entrepreneurship. We may call this top-down sort of knowledges and expertise. At the same time, because Syriza sort of emanated, as some claim, also as part of the anti-austerity movements, their members were heavily involved in these movements, which is why from the outset, the Ministry of Labor that was tasked with drafting the law facilitated formal and informal consultations to somewhat democratize the drafting process. So this included ministry employees traveling to the Greek periphery and other like cities in the country to consult with social entrepreneurs, activists, informal groups, but also precursor SSE model businesses, if you will, as well as, of course, roughly 400 comments via the Greek Open Government Initiative. To give an example of how knowledges sort of got into this law, this is a social entrepreneur who I interviewed, and I asked them, I remember your colleague saying that you pointed out the lack of social impact measurement in the consultations, that it was really you who pushed for the law to include, and they replied, yes, we were, regarding social impact. Okay, we don't take all the credit, but it was a thing we really disagreed with and we articulated it, and we weren't allowed to set that in this way. This is to highlight the fusion in part of, you know, incommensurable moral and political values and expectations, which come at the cost of a set of tensions in the making of the law and that are very much embodied in the law itself. Just briefly, two of the pertinent ones is, what is the law actually to achieve? Is it about producing an alternative economy, or is it that is really transformative in nature, or is it about sort of an active labor market policy that very much mitigates unemployment? Here, a policymaker informed me that this was part of the battle within Syriza, where the party or the base was about the alternative economy and the government was about the labor market, the latter of which it seems has won sort of this battle. At the same time, what does it mean if we fuse market versus non-market rationalities under one umbrella? This is about the codification of these incommensurable logics in a common legal framework and the consequences of subjecting them to the same modes of valuation. What does this do to questions pertaining to the social and solidarity? Alas, and this may come as no surprise, funding was an issue from the outset. Although the Social Economy Fund was envisioned, it was never established. So the only major public source was the Greek Partnership Program, popularly known as ESPA programs, co-funded by the EU Structural Investment Funds. As one interlocutor sort of very much summarizes all of these tensions, they told me, in a cooperative, you sometimes have more exploitation than in non-cooperative conditions because the members become micro-entrepreneurs and exploit themselves as much as possible to make ends meet. And we experience this every day. The market always creates pressure. It's really this that asphyxiates you and limits the social impact you could have created otherwise. So in effect, Syriza's turn towards assuming that the social and solidarity economy can be both an active labor market policy and an alternative mode of production, but without providing meaningful funding to sort of sustainably start up the sector, this came at the cost of undermining the transformative ambitions of the law from the outset. And this is because SSE actors are themselves in an ambiguous position. On the one hand, they become wardens of mitigating the precarizing consequences of economic uncertainty by managing certain forms of social needs provision. In this sense, they are profiting from the deregulation of previously state-held responsibilities. On the other hand, however, by participating in a precarious labor market, they are themselves subject to competition and economic uncertainty and therefore in need of protection. So what are the practical consequences of sort of the hybrid economic formulation of the law and the tensions we've just outlined? I'd like to suggest three, which are economization, entrepreneurialization, and communitarianization. Before we talk about them in length, let's just look at the law sort of and how it defines the social and solidarity economy. Here, it's the sum of economic activities which are founded on an alternative organization of the relationship of production, distribution, consumption, and reinvestment based on the principles of democracy, equality, solidarity, cooperation, and respect to the human being, the environment. So this is very much transformative sort of an ambition. At the same time, if we look into sort of the components that make the law, we have an inherently productive and somewhat formalistic relationship between means and ends, as well as an audit of this relationship. The goal of the law is for SSE organizations to produce social benefit. There's also collective benefit that has to do with legal form, but I'm not going to delve into this because of time limits. But this is defined as serving the social needs of the local or wider community in a socially inclusive manner. Now, the means to produce social benefit are, amongst others, social innovation and solidarity, which curiously is not defined in at much length, sustainable development activities, and regulated profit distribution, including horizontal modes of decision-making. Social impact measurements then evaluate this relationship, or to put it differently, the social is conceived of as a good that serves a benefit. The value of the benefit is evaluated precisely by these social impact measurements. Now, social enterprise organizations that are included in the registry of the social and solidarity economy are required to submit yearly impact evaluations. And the social impact measurement tool of the government's website includes sort of quantitative approaches required to measure the change, and you may need to create your own indicators to demonstrate a change that has taken place. Asking a policymaker why it is important to measure impact, they point to how we cannot change the world if we do not change ourselves, very much highlighting the normative and incentivizing sort of role of measurement to incentivize particular forms of behavior. Now, subjecting SSE practices to this mode of quantified valuation does allow for rendering the previously incommensurable moral and political spheres and tensions as now commensurable and comparable via indicators, numbers, or quasi-numerical ways of knowing. But because social economy actors are encouraged to create their own indicators, they effectively at times invent rather than represent a social reality. And this measured reality then comes at the cost of devaluing that which is not visible. Let me give you an example of a member of an employee cooperative. And I quote, "I reread an impact survey we did, and sure, there were some things that were important, but the way we usually write them is the way they're supposed to be read, incredibly overestimated. I think it's fake. Some people at an event, for example, might understand some things, but you cannot count this, you cannot quantify this." Again, morally ambiguous. So this first of all underlines, as Steffen Mau informs us, that impact surveys prioritize those indicators that can be quantified. And this in turn may lead to what is called target centeredness or criteria reductionism. In effect, what this does is that social impact measurement replaces critique with technique and qualitative judgment with quantitative measurement, as Will Davies informs us. So here, to put it differently, sort of the political metaphysics of solidarity and the social are reduced to political physics of technical procedure. And this is why measurement effectively economizes the relation between solidarity and the social, reducing it to sort of efficiency maximizing acts of valuation. Presenting a policymaker with this reading, I ask, what does it mean if we think about solidarity as social return on investment? Don't we reproduce a logic that is in and of itself trapped in utility maximization? And they reply, at times of movement outbursts, social solidarity is there and truly produces results. But in times of movement hibernation, like the one we're living now, these are interviews I conducted this year, there is no consistency in solidarity, so you don't help maximizing it. What has a lot of importance is that solidarity is consistent, that it is more universal and can represent more people. But I think that if nothing else, it secures a salary for people who want to deal with this. This is indispensable. Again, this is not about the intentionality of sort of, you know, supporting the people that work there, but rather the epistemic consequences. Arguably, the need to create consistency via impact audits in effect substitutes trust and qualitative judgment with control and quantitative audit, as Jerry Miller informs us in Tyranny of Metrics. Secondly, social return on investment or social impact are not epistemologically neutral. Their underlying Benthamite utilitarian assumptions about values subtly reduce questions of solidarity to issues of efficiency maximization. This is also problematic because the valorization of these practices via salary incentives camouflages the devolution of previously state-based social needs provision onto SSE actors. So in a pragmatist sense, the imaginable consequences of this economization may well be that issues pertaining to inequality and precarity are treated as quantifiable aggregate costs in a Coasean sense, which ought to be evaluated by impact methodologies and mitigated not by the welfare state, but, as I will show in the next section, by the entrepreneurial innovations of SSE organizations. Indeed, entrepreneurship studies informs us that innovation is at the heart of activity. The law foresees that the new emerges predominantly through social innovation, which is defined as the production of products and the provision of services, which aim at the satisfaction of social needs, the reconciliation of production and consumption, the harmonization of supply and demand, and the formation of a new type of social relations based on collectivity imperative and not on competition. It's important to highlight the demarcation from competition and the valorization of alternative practices. On the other hand, codifying social innovation around collectivity camouflages merely the reality that the SSE is indeed a market sector, which by definition is based on forms of competition and creates inequalities. This is important because this puts pressure on SSE actors to innovate. Indeed, the fact that the law defines social innovation through the reconciliation and the harmonization of supply and demand is puts the market first of all center stage and is reminiscent of economic equilibrium models or Pareto efficiency. Arguably then, social innovation here is not so much based on the Schumpeterian ideal of creative destruction. Instead, it is a more harmonious kind of entrepreneurship that further naturalizes innovation, where solidarity is formed by socially conscious practices, but market practices nonetheless, that efficiently allocate resources and needs provision. In a sense then, this is a reinvigoration of ordo-liberal principles of fairness and social justice in the name of solidarity. To illustrate sort of the in the name of solidarity and how it plays out, here's an answer of an interlocutor regarding the role of creativity and innovation in social enterprise practice. And I quote, "We started with a lot of social, we then took it to a lot of urban. Now imagine a program comes up, for example, which gives us 45,000 euros only for environmental. Hence, we now turn it to environmental only. This is adaptability." First of all, it's important, of course, that these logics happen in a competitive market where you need to sort of compete for scarce funding. As a matter of fact, my interlocutor, he used these words in English, although the interview was conducted in Greek, which points to the perhaps Anglo-Saxon tradition of social entrepreneurship. But at the same time, the branding logic of works is more to satisfy donor requirements and risks committing what Jim Butler refers to as empty moralizing. At the same time, the notion of adaptability to market signals is grounded in an entrepreneurial ethos that places agency, responsibility, and success firmly on the SSE actor, rather than on structural constraints of scarce and unequally distributed resources. An interim conclusion. If economization is a process of exhausting the ethical and political components of solidarity in the social, to quantifiable aggregates of maximized utility, then entrepreneurialization exploits the fact that these components are now exhausted to innovate services and products in the name of solidarity. Now, from what we know from cultural economy approaches and critical valuation studies, but also governmentality studies, is that processes of economization and entrepreneurialization effectively depoliticize questions pertaining to the social. But what we observe in the social and solidarity economy in Greece, however, is not that it's depoliticized, rather it's the communitarianization of solidarity. What does that mean? Asking an interlocutor, how do you define solidarity? They replied, look, that depends. It's different for everybody. I cannot define it generally. Now, what is communitarian about this is that it renders solidarity as radically contingent rather than normative, ontological, and universally applicable. Communitarianism is a reaction to the excessive individualism proliferated in much of liberal thought by highlighting the strong relationship between the individual and the community. For communitarians like Charles Taylor and Amitai Etzioni, there are no a priori political or moral principles. Rather, the community is the condition for the emergence of political moral principles. What follows from this then is that there cannot be a politics that is organized around universal principles that apply equally to all people, as Will Davies informs us. How does this play out then? Asked about how a social enterprise can practice solidarity and produce social benefit, an interlocutor told me, look, what I say to be cool with myself and those around me is, people who work towards not only economic sustainability, but also social impact. I include some categories like eco-friendly, empowering employees, run by vulnerables, gifts back to society, enterprises that include it in their branding. They self-identify like this. I ask them, how do we judge if they do this practically? And the reply is, this is why I'm telling you. They themselves need to say that. This way I can judge them, but also consumers. And they can say, guys, exclude them. Now, to be cool with points precisely to the ethical quality of SSE practice. On the one hand, this quality embodies that the entrepreneurializing tendencies of branding practices pertaining to the social and solidarity. On the other hand, it is market signals via consumer behavior that evaluate this quality. Arguably, non-communitarianized solidarity reproduces the inequalities of the market in that it conditions how the community, that is the SSE community, evaluates who is or isn't deserving of participating in the social solidarity economy. Here, the contingent ethics of communitarianized solidarity are informed precisely by the indexical nature of market signals. The methods of evaluating this are, for example, impact measurements that shape what counts as solidarity. And this is because although the market in the social and solidarity economy draws from the ethical and political character of solidarity in the social, it remains central in formulating and regulating them. At the same time, and this is sort of the last point before I finalize this talk, is what is the positive? It's something that sort of was very important to Mandelotus. Attributes such as positive social change, contributing something positive, doing the best, and so on and so forth. As one interlocutor informs us, when you are in the social space, be it social solidarity or collaborative or whatever, you want a better world, you want a better condition, all right? It's the same for everybody. The question is how you do it and what it is that you actually do. We see people who really, through their job, want to offer something positive to society. Now, first of all, there's a minimum consensus on what that everybody wants to do something good. In communitarian thought, as Majid Yar informs us, what is good and what is positive is that which ensures the frictionless and healthy functioning of a society. A form of community equilibrium that is akin to sustainability, as Davis tells us. Firstly, this overlaps with the grand narrative of social entrepreneurship as harmonious rather than conflictual social change, as Pascal Day and Chris Steyert inform us. Secondly, the ethical value judgment of what positive entails is contingent upon the very evaluative methods, and think here, social impact measurement, that as we've seen in the economization section, SSE actors are encouraged to themselves create. Analogous to positive psychology then, which is itself grounded in communitarian thought, goodness and positivity run risk of becoming an end in itself. Yet, this comes at the cost of invisibilizing what is negative or deviant, and in turn, the conflicts over the structural conditions of human vulnerability. To finalize, and this is just a note that under the current New Democracy government, the sector has received little attention and the General Secretariat of the Social and Solidarity Economy has been downgraded. Conceptually, some final remarks though, because I think these logics transcend the social and solidarity economy. So first of all, the seeming valorization of hybrid economic practices camouflages the state's partial withdrawal from social needs provision. This withdrawal does not signify a deregulation of social needs provision as much as a re-regulation along different terms. Now, because the SSE is the partial result of austerity, it is institutionalized in a way that is dependent upon the public sector for support and the private sector for economic success, which, as Asha Amin tells us, puts limit on the alternative of the social solidarity economy. Hybrid economic practices have allowed those organized and working in the SSE to provide some forms of previously public social needs provision in a way that does not signify a radical betrayal of their ethical and political positions, but rather a continuation and recuperation, albeit in critical, complicit ways. Now, again, the hope of this talk is by visibilizing the limits of sort of hybrid economic practices in the SSE, we can strengthen the emancipatory potentiality of this sector rather than undermine it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dimitri. It was a very, very interesting talk. I have many notes that I kept and a few questions as well, and very well timed as well. Thank you very much for that. We are going to open in a few minutes to questions from the audience. So please, members of the audience, please post your questions using the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen. I will collate questions and then address them to Dimitris. But let me start immediately with some of my own questions, if I may, starting from something that you covered, so in the latter part of your presentation. You seem to be presenting, if I understood correctly, as a sign of a problematic characteristic, the fact that, you know, within the communitarianism aspect that you were covering, that some of your interviewees said that this is completely self-defined, and if they say that they're doing solidarity, you know, solidarity is defined, or if they say that they're working on the social economy, that's it, and the consumers perhaps would judge it. And if that is a problem, then that is also a reason why you would need the metrics. And I understand the problem with metrics also in very different worlds. Even in academia, we have a problem with metrics and how much they define what is to be valued, and they give unbalanced weights to different aspects of the work that we do. But in a way, by bringing in metrics and at the same time allow the sector to define their own metrics, as you were saying in the economization part of your presentation, in a way it resolves this, I don't know if it's a kind of free rider problem, but the problem of somebody pretending to be offering something which has a social value and just using the brand, if you want, or positioning themselves to access European Union money. So if we were to reevaluate that, the kind of implicit or explicit critique that you gave on the social impact measurement aspect, under the light of what you're saying later on communitarianism, can we be a bit less critical on the metrics and on the metrics approach to it? So if I don't know if you understand my question, but if you can respond to that, yeah.
Okay, right away?
Yeah, if you don't mind.
All right, thanks, Vasily, for this question. I think we can be, you know, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong. I'm just like with valorizing it per se. This is not necessarily an ethical judgment. It's rather to say that metrics do stuff. I mean, they have a performative quality and they have their own effective appeal, but they produce a reality that is inherently where ethical and political components become invisible. And I think what I've tried to show is like how this plays out in practice, how this in effect, you know, entrepreneurialized some of the practices by emptying out the moral and political questions, and in effect turns something that what I understand has to be universal and normative into something radically contingent, such as solidarity. Does this answer your question?
I mean, yes, no, it does. So partly linked to that, is there also an inherent tension between allowing, you know, this very in a way very bottom-up involvement of actors who want to contribute, they feel solidaristically and they want to contribute social value through the social economy. Obviously this comes with some sort of an agenda. You know, if the money go, if we focus on the urban and the money comes to environment, we shift our focus to environment. But it also works the other way around, that, you know, there's environmental groups or individuals involved in them that they would want to focus on that aspect of the social economy, and others who would want to focus on another aspect, migrant integration, or whatever else, you know, gender issues, minority issues, and so forth. And in a way, you know, the actions of the individuals and of the groups to which they belong will define also what is the, how the social economy is defined in a particular place. So isn't it that it is inherently non-universalistic? You know, the values are defined by the participants rather than, wanting to have, as you seem to suggest, you know, we want to have some sort of universal measure of what is social value.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a question then. I mean, this is an inherently political question as to what solidarity is supposed to do. I mean, if solidarity is really sort of the unconditional, if you win mutual aid, the ways in which I defined it with Rakopoulos and Lynch and Kalaitzaki, then it cannot be a contingent relationship. Hypothetically, if you choose to provide solidarity with some and not with others, you know, it becomes a different relationship. And I think what happens here is that it's not so much, it's how the market navigates who is and isn't deserving of solidarity. And the consequence is then that solidarity changes. The subjective ways in which my interlocutors make meaning of what solidarity is changes because of these structural constraints. Now, I can provide a normative value judgment of whether or not I think this is good or not. And I do, I think, as you can tell from my talk. But this is rather a form of critique where I want to, you know, sort of raise these toxic assumptions to the level of discourse we can see them, rather than merely saying this is bad. Hypothetically, if I just may say something, I think what my issue with communitarianism is if there is an inherent, if it's the community that decides and there is no a priori principles, then hypothetically racism and how we define racism is also part for the community. If the community decides that a particular sort of racism doesn't exist, then this is what it is. So I think some things, it's like this interplay between what can be relative and what must be normative, sort of in order to structure society, that I wanted to shed light on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think on that, just to continue on this point, because I find it very interesting that exactly, you know, you have to be extremely normative in order to, like, by giving your own definition of what is social economy, you're extremely normative. And you can have somebody who gets involved on very similar issues, let's say from the side of kind of the political ecology, let's say, versus somebody who comes in from a more perhaps socially regressive, more traditionalist, from the kind of rural agricultural point of view. And then the views on what is allowed or what is allowed to be the focus within the you know, how solidarity is defined can be very different and often very conflictual. And of course, the case of racism versus solidarity to migrants, for example, is also a more extreme on that. I think it would be interesting to come back to these points, but let me take some questions from the audience, if I may. So a very good former colleague, I should say, Bernard Casey, is asking about one of his long-time passions about pension funds. He says, I'm looking at whether pension funds can invest responsibly. Is it possible to have a comment of that? After all, these funds have a fiduciary responsibility. So can pension funds invest responsibly, I guess, more on the social economy and on solidaristic grounds? Or is this something that, you know, we're trying to put too much into what they can do, given that, of course, they have to worry about the returns in much more market terms? I imagine that's the spirit of the question of Bernard.
I mean, I don't know if I feel qualified to answer this question, to be honest, because I don't know how it plays out. I think, you know, the idea of pension funds being something that you reinvest in order to produce a dividend is sort of a market approach to social welfare protection, if I understand correctly. So if this is like the case, then, you know, this in of itself is it's still the market that regulates the ways in which solidarity is produced. So this arguably then changes the ways in which we think through solidarity. I think these would be consequences, whether or not this is good or not. I don't know. I don't know enough about this, to be honest.
Okay. I mean, there's also, the bigger issue of sort of responsible investment, green investment, that goes also beyond the pension funds. Recently, it came to my attention that there's even different types of the greener bitcoins and or types of cryptocurrencies and less green. So there's also delineations there.
Right, but just to chip in, I mean, this would be an example, I think, of alleviating market failures rather than transforming them, because it reproduces the structural logic of it. And that's inherently political sort of question of whether or not this reproduction of alleviation, you know, what is the cost of it, would pragmatic sociologists sort of ask, because you reproduce inevitably sort of the logics of accumulation. So it's not, it doesn't seem to be as transformative as other systems without being able to like provide an alternative per se.
Yeah. We have another question by Paul Delgado, but if I may, I would like to pick up on this thing about market failures, Dimitri, because also, I mean, you know, it was something, of course, that you mentioned in the first part of your presentation. So, I mean, you know, if, as an economist, the problem with market failures is that, I mean, you know, one of the problems of market failures is kind of separation between the private cost or private returns and the social cost or social returns. So, you know, you have under provision of good things because the private provider can or the producer cannot internalize all the benefits of that. There's positive externalities and likewise over provision of bad things because again, the provider doesn't internalize all the costs. So this separation. So in the way that you talked about the alleviating market failures, it wasn't very clear whether that is by you know helping internalize costs and benefits or by coming completely out of the principle of you know essentially this kind of cost benefit maximization calculation and then which then probably links more to what you're talking about sort of how the state essentially subcontracts or externalizes the provision to the third sector. So can you talk to us a bit more about you know the conception of alleviating market failures within your literature?
I mean, the alleviation is basically it's just a reef from a literature review in which I looked into approaches. And for me, what alleviates market failures is based on market derived practices that do not sort of address the root causes, but rather than instead of the symptoms of inequality. So to me, this would be all kinds of practices, such as the hybrid economic practices that I presented, that are based on utilitarian, Benthamite utilitarian ideas about cost and value. So this to me is alleviative. Basically, hybrid economic practices come at the cost of alleviating. I think this is, I wonder, like, for example, if we need social, if social innovation is really something that is required in order to produce transformation, innovation being inherently sort of market derived. So, I mean, this is sort of how the research also started. My hunch or my feeling was that this is not, yeah, sort of critiqued enough, I feel, in both literature and practice. There's different modes of producing novel social relations beyond market-derived practices. So again, alleviation to me is stuff that comes, reproduces a market ethos that's grounded in the ways of knowing that the market presents to us, and the market being sort of the marketized economy and the disciplines, the hegemonic disciplines, such as economics.
It's more about the ethos rather than filling gaps that for which traditionally, there was no market, and that's why the state came in to provide because the market failed to provide. It's more about the ethos rather than about the...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So hypothetically, then the state could also reproduce, and it does, I think. The state has not withdrawn. It rather re-regulates and draws them itself from impact methodologies and audit. It undergoes the very same processes of economic modes of valuation.
Okay, very good. So let me bring in the question by Paul Linares Delgado. Could social solidarity be defined as supporting people who are not part of our inner circle of friends and family? I thought of that because we can help them, but from a paternalistic perspective that we do not have with our own close peers. Shall I repeat the question or do you have access also to the question?
No, I read it. I'm trying to wrap my head around. I guess why I don't know. I'm not sure why.
I think
it's a question about definition, then how we could define it. I don't know. I guess. I mean, the question again here to me is not necessarily to like claim authority as to what solidarity is and isn't, but rather how we approach practices of solidarity and how a particular ethos that's market based changes the ways in which we think solidarity. So I don't know if I could like answer this question. I think yes, we could.
Could you perhaps comment a bit on the kind of second latter part of the question about so can you know by supporting so segments of society, let's say, which are outside from our inner circle, can this only be paternalistic? So I guess if it is paternalistic, it's less solidaristic in a way because you define the needs of the other, you know, of your kind of client, customer.
Hmm. I'm not sure I fully understand this question, to be honest. I'm sorry. Maybe okay,
Paul, if you would like to come back with a bit of more explanation, I'll move on to another question. You mentioned, of course, the middle of your presentation, the social impact investment. How do you measure impacts? And of course, you talked about how you measure impacts. Well, you talk more about, you know, something about measuring impacts. You seem to take a stance that, you know, you suggest we shouldn't measure impacts. Can you also elaborate a bit on that? And is there alternative ways in which we could measure impacts that would not be so limiting? And or is there some sort of, you know, positive suggestion of not measuring at all?
I think my critique with measurement is not that we try to evaluate things, that we want to understand sort of consequences. It's rather that measurements, precisely because they are based on quantitative ways of reasoning, you know, sort of reduce judgment to measurement. So it's a different set of authorities, sort of an epistemologist it draws from. This comes always at the cost of invisibilizing these things that can't be measured. For example, everything that has to do with emotional forms of labor or reproductive labor is harder to measure. I'm just saying that this has consequences. I just wanted to highlight the consequences. So yes, I'm sure you can measure social impact investment, but this comes at the cost of changing the ways in which the social is conceived. And this is precisely what I wanted to get across with my talk.
And on this, would there be some practices, for example, that would be, you know, allow a more neutral way of assessing and then, you know, measuring and comparing between providers, between sectors or whatever. If the quantification of when you do the impact assessment reduces things in a way that shapes them, changes them, then are there other options that would have a more neutral effect on that?
I think it's not about neutrality, it's about the claim of neutrality, and in so doing, naturalizing that which is actually not neutral at all, but reproduces inherently economized realities. So I think prior to impact evaluations and all of the auditing culture, you know, that came sort of from the 1970s, 80s onward, a lot of stuff was more qualitative in nature. I don't think that, so I mean, in theory, we could look into what's been before the audit culture and sort of the obsession with measuring everything and what, you know, Müller calls the tyranny of metrics. I don't think there is a need to reinvent them. I think a lot of the judgments we perform at the end of the day are qualitative. The question is what sort of does it do when they're informed solely or mostly on positivist impact-based sort of knowledges. And again, like to reiterate, I think this comes at the cost of changing the ways in which we conceive of the social and solidarity.
Okay, Bernard insists on this question and qualifies with many more comments, but I think it is about the, sort of the subjectivity and whether you can have a universal kind of normative definition of that. So I'll let you respond to that, Dimitri, at your own time. But in the meantime, can I bring in another question? You mentioned in relation to one of your interviewees, not sure if it was a practitioner or a policymaker, but you said that impact surveys, in the impact surveys, we overestimate the impact. Kind of systematically, I guess. And so what, you know, that rang a bell about so practices in the Soviet Union under central planning. And I mean, you know, obviously practices that had to do with kind of box ticking and everything, but also a systematic, so a structure of incentives that inevitably, you know, like irrespective of the behavior of the person, inherently pushed towards either underreporting of outputs or overreporting of outputs, depending on the, you know, what the reporting was used for. And then, of course, this affects also the actual provision, you know, because then you do not focus on what you actually deliver, but you focus on how can you present a particular picture in relation to what you deliver. So I don't presume you know much about sort of social economic relations in the Soviet Union, but do you think, or is there anything in the literature that would tell us that the social economy suffers from the problems that, I don't know, Hayek identified with the you know, with the Soviet system? Do we know something about the social economy that it is so much not the market principles that it then becomes this kind of inefficient system with very skewed incentives? And basically, I mean, you know, it's one thing not to aim at maximizing utility and quite another to openly accept that I'm going to let utility go down the drain.
Mm. So your question is basically what ways, how I understand it is, what other ways of efficient allocation are there other than...
No, just simply if we know from the literature, I guess, or from, you know, the insights you got from your own fieldwork, whether the structure of incentives in the social economy, solidarity economy, is so, if it's, you know, inherently problematic, as we know now that it was under, you know, under communism in the Soviet Union. So if the structure of incentives unavoidably leads to people moving from the, if you want, even their normative targets to actually a lot of box ticking and behavior that is not consistent with the initial, you know, why they came in the first place.
Mm. I mean, one of the things I think that's problematic is, first of all, if the market, you know, as my first interlocutor indicated, the market does create pressures and competition that sort of undermines the transformative ambitions, or as they said, the social impact you could produce. So in this sense, it is a change of incentive. If it is true that economization really reduces sort of political metaphysics, political physics, aggregates that you can now compare, and you have sort of now an emptied out version of the social and solidarity, and entrepreneurializing brands them and mobilizes them in the name of solidarity, then I think this in and of itself is examples of how the purpose is changing. If you compete for funding, sometimes you are forced to first look into what are donor requirements and what are funding lines, and, you know, sort of what needs to be done is second. So this inevitably comes at the cost of reducing and changing incentives. And, you know, funding requirements are a competitive sort of market. I don't think this is exclusive to the social economy. The question is in how far this, you know, and what does this competition do basically initially to what you wanted to do? And I think in the social economy, these examples that I provided and sort of these indicative findings are precisely how solidarity is at times mobilized as a brand or as a label through which you can then require resources.
Thanks. We have a few questions coming through, so let me take them in the order they came. So our colleague Philip Katsinas is asking, from following from your conclusions, Dimitri, can the social and solidarity economy or alternative economies be transformative at all, or are they inevitably recuperated in the mainstream economy?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Because this is sort of the one that I'm struggling with, because obviously the point of this critique is not to say it's pointless. It's rather to highlight what it does to draw from these things. I think with the formalization of the Syriza government, inevitably actors have been co-opted, you know, purposefully or not. Legal recognition sort of co-opts many of these practices and aligns them to legal and survey requirements. I think there's plenty of informal economy actors that, you know, do provide alternatives. The social health clinics, for example, do not obey these logics. I'm thinking that the problem is not the social economy per se, but rather a marketized approach to the social economy. And I think although the Syriza government tried to produce something transformative, in effect, they reproduced many of the ideas that actually, you know, co-opt by chance or not. I would think that part of the problem is obviously also, you know, the austerity program and the requirements of the austerity program and what you could actually do. Although the social and solidarity economy explicitly was not part of the third adjustment program. So they had a little bit of leverage there. But I think to just answer your question, Philip, there always will be some form of reproduction, if you know pragmatic sociologists are right to assume that this is what critique does. The question is, how can we minimize marketized economy ideas? And I think for a start, such ideas as impact measurement, you know, that economize social relationships or social innovation, for example, I think we can do without them in social economy practice. I think the epistemics are the problem here because they have consequences for transformative practice. The question is then, you know, how can we go beyond ideas of the entrepreneurial and so on and so forth?
Dimitri, you mentioned social clinics, so there's a question of that relates to this, so let me read it out. Speaking specifically of the solidarity clinics across Greece, sometimes called SSCP, social solidarity clinics and pharmacies, my understanding is that some of these are also consciously challenging Western ways of practicing medicine. For example, a clinic in Thessaloniki is exploring holistic approaches to health. I wonder if this is an important aspect of these clinics.
I
know you don't claim expertise on social.
No, clinics. I really don't know. I don't know about their approach to medicine. I'm sorry. I don't think I can give a good answer to this. But I do think social solidarity clinics that emerged sort of are a good example of sort of solidarian relations that do not economize social relations and transform solidarity. So these are examples that are already there. But to this, I'm sorry, I don't have a good answer for this.
I mean, if I can sort of take ownership of the question, you know, and make it link it to something I asked earlier, it is in a way, is what makes these clinics SSC? Is it the fact that they try to reach out to people who are one way or another excluded from, you know, due to market principles, the price mechanism, let's say. So they try to reach, so there's a social solidaristic objective of reaching out to individuals who are excluded from the market. Is this the key defining, if you want, characteristic that would include them as SSC sector? Or is also the content, the objective of moving away from some sort of, you know, having, if you want, a normative or non-normative, whatever, critique of Western medicine and wanting to push people away from the essentially, you know, drug dependency that the Western medicine in a way cultivates and into more holistic approach to health. Would this by itself be something that classifies efforts like this, initiatives like this as SSC?
I think that's an interesting thought, Vasily. I mean, I, again, do not know about medicine, but if we reduce sort of, if we translate it, as you said, to pharmacy and the ways in which pharmacy works, then I think, yes, that would be probably a good way to look into. I agree. I wonder, though, if this is part of the social, I think this is part of the solidarity movement. I don't know if social solidarity clinics are part of the social and solidarity economy.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So let me bring the other question by Paul Delgado again. I think in follow up to what we're discussing earlier as well. So I think this is about self interest versus family altruism. But as we evolved caring mainly for our own inner circle of close friends and family, we can understand why people in position of power are also mainly caring from the inner circle. And not strongly changing the world in benefit of lower socioeconomic segments, but just doing solidarity, in quotation marks. How do you think this social economical behavior can be changed to make a real improvement in inequality? I will allow you to interpret the question in the way that works better for you.
Um, Mainly caring, strongly caring. I think there's a lot of assumptions in there that I'm not sure I can fully sort of disentangle. I don't know, how would you translate, is this about how can need to care for this? I mean, this is based on the assumption that this is just how things are. I don't know if this is true, actually. So on this basis, I don't know how I can answer this question properly.
Okay, and I think this assumption about the position on power of people in position of power doing kind of just doing solidarity also would fit more to, if you're on a state provider, the government provision than to people in the SSC, because I think you were also saying you cannot automatically assume that these are people in position of power, because they are in some way also vulnerable themselves because they're subject of the competition, isn't it?
Precisely. I think these are like really interesting. This is what I found sort of most fascinating about this research. The social economy is so interesting because they are at the same time guardians, or at least have become sort of guardians of some forms of social provision, but at the same time, they're also subject to this uncertainty. This is what I wanted to sort of outline in the beginning. The question is, of course, what is the role of the state then in all of this? I think which maybe is an answer to this question. My hunch was, from the ways in which I talked to Syriza policymakers, that they had an inherently sort of social liberal idea about the welfare state. This is not to say that the welfare state is there to just provide, but rather to provide people with the means to help themselves, in the sense, which is of course a shift from the ideas of what the welfare state should be doing relative to, you know, Keynesian, if you will, welfare provision, so on and so forth. What I also think, what I'm struggling with, or what I find interesting to this regard is, I mean, other, what kind of imaginary does this produce also in terms of, I mean, this is not privatized solidarity provision, right? So this is something else entirely. But what does it do to the imagination of the state of being the provider of welfare, presuming that the state should have such a role, right? But does it not counter also? And this is what I wanted to say. Does it not camouflage previous responsibilities, valorizing sort of all of these innovative potentials? Yes, they are progressive, but at the same time, some of the state of welfare sort of has obviously gotten worse and worse over the years.
Yeah, and I guess also the funding issue, it is, you know, because you have less continuity in terms of funding, especially if you are, you know, again, the example that you gave, if you move from health provision to environment, just because that's where the money is, then of course the continuity of the service. So this relates to another question that we have on by Bernard again on, I think he's insisting on this, but I like the last version of his question, is like, who is paying for social solidarity? And of course you mentioned the fund that was created but not activated in Greece, and the fact that the money come essentially from European cohesion funds. So, I mean, you know, so I guess the answer is ultimately the taxpayer pays for it, but who pays, and I guess also who should pay in a way for this?
Right, these are all political rather than analytical questions. So, I mean, I think, you know, as it currently stands, because the social solidarity fund has never been established, the main line of funding has been ESPA programs. And under the current government, it seems as though, although that there is no substantial funding being provided. So on the one hand, the sole sort of, there's public and there's private, of course, like funding that you do by trading. And then there is these European Union funds. The question on who should be paying for this, I don't know. I mean, I guess the question is, what is the social solidarity economy to do, going back to this? If it's merely an unemployment sort of policy, or if it's a transformative economy, and based on these, and these tensions exist though. And because this is not clear, it's hard for me to say what, you know, who should be paying for this. I don't know. I don't know what to.
Yeah.
Because this is, you know.
I mean, of course, it's interesting in the context of, as you say, if it is the state withdrawing its services and sort of making space and inviting the third sector.
But this is, I think, part of the problem of why I find it hard to answer this question. If we are to assume that part of the social economy includes actors now taking over previously welfare functions. So starting off the question of who should pay for this, it begins at the middle, you know what I mean? It's like to say, should there be a social and solidarity economy that takes over practices that were previously sort of provided by the welfare state and are now in a way monetized, you know, or incentivized by salaries? So these are the questions. If we are to think through alleviation and transformation, if we are to think through alleviation, you know, then I think, you know, it would make sense if there is strong public funding. If we're thinking through transformation, I don't think that this question has, or it's difficult to come to transformative ends.
Yeah. Okay, I do want to ask the active labor market policies question because it's an area very close to my work, but also from the labor economic side. But let me take another question from the audience on the issue of quantification and, of course, the measurement thing that we discussed already. Do you see the problem with quantification to be the reductiveness, so reducing care relations to numbers, or the error of immutability, numbers never lie? An example, Graeber has argued how quantification of debt is what makes debt forgiveness such an alien idea to us. Would you say that these two aspects of reduction and immutability cannot really be disentangled, or you would prioritize one of the two?
That's a good question. I think for me, the problem and the ways in which the task being to understand what it does to the social and solidarity bits of the social and solidarity economy, I think quantification does reduce. It's not reducing care. Yes, reducing care relations to numbers. And therefore, in this example, change the ways in which care sort of is conceived. I don't know if they're mutually exclusive, though. Because I do think the fact that they have their effective appeal, that, as Porter informed us, and precisely this is why we assume that they don't lie, and this is sort of the allure, I think, of quantification. I don't know if they can be disentangled. I think they are part and parcel of the same thing. I would like to know, for example, why would we need to disentangle them? Like, genuinely interested.
I guess, to what extent you can dispute a reality. I mean, you know, like as an economist, I would say that, you know, the numbers have this good thing that you can know when you disagree. Whereas if you leave everything to a narrative and everything is kind of self-defined and subjective, then it's very difficult to have some sort of definitive yes-no kind of answer. Whereas, you know, with statistics, you can lie, but also you can have a kind of a definitive response to it. Dimitri, I think we're going to be coming to a close, but let me ask this active labor market policy question. And that was in relation to a policymaker from Syriza that you quoted. What exactly was the thing there? Was it just the practical thing of taking people out of the unemployment registry by creating jobs, haphazard jobs, and, you know, probably precarious jobs themselves in that are creating the social economy? Or was there something about was it about the people who work in the social economy, or was it about the people benefiting from the social economy, either directly as kind of users or more broadly by the presence of the social economy as a sector? Was there more to it than just taking people out of the OIF unemployment benefit at all?
You mean the task of the social and solidarity economy for Syriza's governmental agenda?
No, because you were saying that there was kind of a debate within Syriza about the law basically being more of an act like an unemployment policy or active labor market policy than actually social solidarity policy. So what was the disagreement there? What was the, I mean, you know, you had the quote, but can you elaborate on this? Because I don't know whether it just means that, yeah, we just mask unemployment by putting people into precarious jobs and funded by European Union programs, or if there was something more to it than just that.
I think from the ways in which I understood sort of this narrative, there was a fundamental, it was just this fundamental issue of what the fundamentally different understandings of what the social economy is, and then of what the social economy should do. The is component is, for example, I'm just paraphrasing here some of the internal bits that I have still in mind, is that the government thought that this is predominantly a policy of mitigating some of the consequences for vulnerable populations. And part of the problem there in the debate is who is vulnerable in a state of utter financial and economic crisis. So how do we make these distinction? I think there were sort of some misunderstandings from the outset. I think the alternative economy bit were precisely those people who came from the movements or the anti-austerity movements and later on joined Syriza. I think these were the two sort of counter movements. And my hunch is from that there was a general misunderstanding. Again, I'm representing here, maybe I'm not doing a great job of what the interview contained. A misunderstanding also of what the alterity of the social economy actually is, and obviously also the austerity programs itself that, you know, require sort of unemployment policies. This was a creeping process. It's not that it happened overnight, because in the early days, even the alternate minister, she was very, very clear that this is not yet another welfare policy, but this has changed over time. And then, you know,
last question, I promise, and then I will let you get some rest on it. But you didn't talk much about the kind of the path dependencies and influences, and obviously there was a reference to the Syntagma Square movement, or the Solidarity movement, you know, that came out of the demonstration, the anti-austerity demonstration. Mm-hmm. And then, I think on the different slide, you also mentioned, of course, the let's say, formative role of the European Commission, for example, the government seeking advice from the, I don't remember the name, but the social economy institution, so to speak, at the European level. So is there a sense of whether the kind of how things, you know, how the sector is defined or kind of delineated in Greece, that it has a particular footprint from the crisis, or has it become essentially European? You know, the EU influence was so big that essentially it's not different from the one in Austria and the one in Portugal and Sweden and whatever.
I mean, first off, like this one slide, I decided to sort of label conjunctures because I'm not sure this works as causalities. Like, for example, I have also narratives that say, no, the social and solidarity economy sector is not a result of the anti-austerity movement. While I have others that say, no, these are people of the social economy. I got into it by following interlocutors who did this way, anti-austerity movement, solidarity movement, social solidarity economy. At the same time, as you say, this coincided, so this is like counterfactual, you don't know exactly with like what the European Commission required, starting the process from 11, I think, till 17 to first of all map the environment of social economy, the social economy, what is it called? Environment, if you will, across the European Union. I know that, and this is what the policymaker told me, that because this was such a new attempt, it fell under three different directorate generals. Like the effort to institutionalize it, which was, I think I wrote it on the slide, it was regional development. I don't have them.
It was, yeah, I think it did grow.
Exactly. And growth and finance. The thing that is why this is, I think, so impactful relative to other policies during the time is that it was not included in the adjustment program. This means that it wasn't micromanaged. So policymakers did indeed have wiggle room, not the funds, but at least the wiggle room. I do think, from what I understand, that this is a fairly progressive sort of approach to the law, not least because of how it's been produced, how it's been democratized by its actors and included formal and informal yes, consultations, and the people who worked on this law also were part of the movements, if you will. But in consequence, and then again, I think there are these reproductive moments that I think are unavoidable, no matter how it is conceived, even if it's imagined as utterly radical and transformative, if it draws from similar techniques, you know, then inevitably it will maybe become another sector like this. This is not to say that this is not, like, this is the inevitable outcome. It's just to how it highlight how this reproduction occurs.
Okay, Dimitri, these are very interesting thoughts, and there's a number of issues that you know, we can reflect on and take forward on this. At this point, I want to thank you very much for your presentation and the extensive discussion. Thanks also to our audience for the questions they put forward. Let me close with two announcements. So our next event is a book launch titled Greece and Cyprus in a Dark Room, 1967-1974, with a speaker, the author Alexis Papachelas, the editor-in-chief of Kathimerini, and chaired by Kevin Featherstone, the director here at the Hellenic Observatory. This is on Thursday, 25th of November, so just over a week, at the same time, 4 o'clock UK time, Thursday, 25 November, Alexis Papachelas speaking on Greece and Cyprus in a Dark Room, 1967-1974. And then our next research seminar is on Tuesday, 30 November, so in 2 weeks' time from now, where we have former High Commissioner of Cyprus to the UK, Ambassador Alexandros Zinon, talking on Cyprus and stability in the Eastern Mediterranean, with Manolis Karayiannis as the discussant, and again chaired by Kevin Featherstone. So our next event, Thursday, 25th of November, and our next research seminar on Tuesday, 30th of November, at a later time, 6 o'clock UK time. Again, thanks to Dimitris for his very interesting presentation and the discussion. Thanks to everybody for joining. See you in one of our future events. Bye-bye.